It's the Lean Into Art Cast, show where a couple visual storytellers get together, take a walk around a, persnickety topic. That'll work this time. And, try to wrestle it to the ground, usually discussing it in the abstract for a little while. And then we do, try to talk about it in a more useful, what am I trying to say here, Rob?
More tangible. It's like something you can actually say. You like a list of, we present a set of things where it's like, you could shop them and say, yeah, that one sounds useful. This one doesn't sound useful. And that's what we're trying to do, is be of service when we think critically about some kind of creative topic.
And you are Rob Stenzinger. You are,
yes, I am,
a visual storyteller. What does that even mean? Explain yourself, sir.
Okay. So a lot of times when I draw something, it's just to, get out an emotion and maybe want to express something, right? I'm drawing a little heavy metal doodle or something. Other times I'm in the mode where I want to actually convey something. I want to have some sort of series of events that I want to share. So to maybe give context, like, why would you care about this topic I'm presenting? And I want to think about the order in which I present those things, and each of those things is something I like to consider as well. Like, how do I catch your eye, and how do I maybe keep your attention, and then go from thing to thing visually, and hopefully overall convey some kind of picture, oftentimes convincing you to spend money. You didn't expect that one, did you?
I'm sorry. I caught another darn cold. I had a cold a week ago, and I caught another one. There's December for you. So, yes, you are a mercenary visual storyteller.
Yes, I am. Exactly.
And guess what? God. I do it for the money, too, because I am what they call these days a graphic novelist. I've done some comic books in my time. I do them for fun, like personal projects like these. I also do them for money. I do freelance illustration. I do storyboarding, and then I teach, and I do public speaking kind of stuff. So both of us tell stories visually in a variety of ways with a variety of technologies, and what we discuss on the show is essentially that. Okay, we've established the show. Now, the way we usually go through it is we start off with a curveball, get ourselves intellectually warmed up, then we dive into the topic and close out with some potentially stupid helpy tips. So, Rob, you said, you hinted, you teased before we started recording that you had a curveball for me.
Yeah, indeed. And what's funny is that I've been lately riffing off of a lot of your wonderful show note preparation. I don't know if listeners, if you know this, but Jersey puts a lot into getting us ready to succeed. So we don't sit here and stare at each other and go, or prattle on incoherently. He gives us this nice, cohesive flow in that same structure that he described. And what's interesting is I've been reacting to it, and sometimes where a curveball happens, where it's like, ooh, this thing, this pain, this whatever puzzle that I've had before, and conveniently it relates to the rest of the show. So anyway, that's kind of fun. So I'm admitting basically where this curveball came from. And okay, related to goals. And I'm wondering, how do you deal with when sort of you set a course, you do a lot of like introspection, reflection, looking around, you come up with some set of things through whatever criteria that you arrive at them. And those set of things, it's like, oh, in 2013, 2012, 2011, or 2014, whatever the year that's about to come, this is what I want to think about or focus on. And so you did all that preparation. What about when it changes? And when your circumstance where you need to sort of pivot or twist or go in a different direction, shift your weight, I'm wondering, do you have what's your approach to that? For recognizing that need to switch somehow? And also, do you do any ritual around it? Kind of like there was a whole ritual before in preparing the goals. Is there any other ritual surrounding that change?
Ooh, ritual surrounding it. Because, oh man, does it ever change, right? You've quoted, I think, Sun Tzu many times on the show. How does that quote go? The plan doesn't survive contact with the ground.
Right, exactly. It's quoted in lots of ways. The best plans don't survive contact with the enemy or encountering with reality, all that kind of stuff. So essentially, or as in the book by the 37 Signals folks, to quote them, planning is guessing.
Mm. Yeah, I'm a big believer in that. Although I think that to oversimplify it or to approach it in a simplistic way is dangerous because it can make it sound nihilistic, right? Well, you can't prepare for the future, so why try, right? Mm-hmm. I'll let things happen as they happen. But man, I mean, here we are at the end of 2013, and I know we set goals and things at the end of 2012. Some of which came through, others changed. Some things fell through, other things popped into being, right? I guess I could be candid for a moment about this. I don't usually like to talk too much about this stuff, but as you know, Rob, early in 2012, I was working hard on a pitch for a graphic novel. Actually, this is pretty, I imagine a lot of people know this, have been following my feeds. Remember in early 2012 that you started seeing all these Boulder and Fleet sketches, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it was while I was putting together a pitch to shop around to the traditional book publishers. Mm-hmm. And I shopped it around. I haven't had a bite yet. I'm waiting to get a bite on that, right? But when I was talking to you in early, like in February 2012, I had it planned out. I'm like, oh, this thing's going to be sold by summer. And I'll be working on it by December 2013 for it to come out in fall of 2014, right? I had this schedule made up for myself. Granted, I didn't have control over a lot of it, but I had a really strong sense of confidence. This pitch is so strong and it's so good that I know somebody's going to bite at it. But there were other factors in there. There's other things about the publishing industry that I didn't know yet. And also, you can't control who's going to say yes or no, right? So that doesn't happen. But then all of a sudden, a different opportunity popped up that I was not looking for. Right, so I'm working on a different graphic novel that comes out next to autumn. So I am in December working on a graphic novel for a major book publisher, which I still don't know how much I'm able to talk about this. Mm-hmm. But that opportunity came out of nowhere. As a matter of fact, when I was asked to be a part of it, there was probably about a 30 second period of me going, oh. not knowing what to say. And I even had to say to the person who asked me, I was like, look, please don't misunderstand my stammering as reluctance. It was more shock than anything else. So yeah, plans change. Do I have a ritual for that though? Because what I had to do then is I had to actually quit a lot of jobs. I had some freelance gigs that I was, lined up to do that I had to turn them down and say, sorry, you're going to find somebody else. I'll help you find somebody else. Had to quit out of some of my teaching gigs that I had lined up. I had to send emails to, the administrators I work with saying, sorry, I have to cancel these classes. I can't do them now because I got this gig that I got to do. But did I have a ritual? Maybe I should, because I'll tell you, for the first couple months I was working on this thing, and as I've told you off mic or off the show, it didn't feel real to me. That's more of a psychological thing, isn't it? That's just me like accepting that the cool thing is happening.
Yeah, big change. It can take a series of, being exposed to it for a while to adapt. I mean, everyone...
But when you say ritual, let me ask you, what do you mean by that? Like what would you do in that situation? Like this big change happens. I think, oh gosh, I'm going to be doing freelance work for the rest of the year. I didn't get the graphic novel job that I wanted. Oh, a new job comes along. What's the ritual you would recommend?
I don't mean to be presumptive about it. And it's sort of me taking, I like to, in a way you're at a similar juncture. But we don't normally observe it as that, right? So you're at some kind of planning juncture that you set out on some intent and you went through some things to be prepared to bring about the outcome you were trying to bring about. But, something changed and now you need to, like what I was wondering is, How do you approach that? Because sometimes I will just keep moving, right? And not worry about it. But maybe I would benefit from taking a moment and mourning the change, right? And being like, man, that sucks. Time to crank up the guitar super loud today, right? And just do something, right? To release that instead of just saying, nope, time to, you know, keep going, soldier on, whatever.
A barbaric yelp.
Maybe. Right?
Yeah.
Or maybe a new kind of gear up, right? Tear up that page, write a new page. I don't know. Doesn't have to be big, doesn't have to be anything other than I was curious if you were dealing with it in a similar way where, you know, okay, here's a big change and okay, cool, just keep rolling.
Yeah, I think I'm cut from a similar piece of cloth as you are on that. I don't remember spending an enormous amount of time dwelling on it. There was maybe a couple hours where when I got my first refusal letter, I was like, aw, I was really hoping to land at that place, but they didn't want it. But then my next thought was, oh, well, somebody else will. Yeah. And I've got plenty to do besides. Keep moving. Keep making things because to sit around and feel bad about it too long is death to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's always, I mean, it's like, okay, I'll just, one of the things we got on our list today is talking about being more honest and forthright about ourselves mm-hmm. and about what our intentions are and our storytelling and everything. And something that I remind myself often, and this is this might come off as hubris to some, is I try to tell myself, like, I'm a pretty intelligent, resourceful guy for the most part. And if I fail at this, I'll figure out a way to succeed at it later, or I'll succeed at something else and try not to get too bound up in it. But it's hard because it is a personal thing, right? It's like when I spent those months crafting that Boulder and Fleet pitch and working really hard on it and really feeling strong and confident about it when I had it delivered to my agent. It's still on the market. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not saying it's over, but that rejection, it felt bad. Mm-hmm. But also, that's part of the thing, isn't it? I mean, show me an author who hasn't seen a rejection letter, right? So I think it'd be...
Exactly. And it's like a lot of times the things that we're building that we start to gain some kind of, well, okay, you're starting to build up a trade and these things don't happen in one giant explosive event, right? There's no big bang of career success. There's no big bang now you've made it, or this is the deal that makes all things, other things possible. You just, you know, keep going and make new choices the next day and see what comes of it. I don't think, and I think that's honestly, I like that approach, but I do wonder, like being someone to find a way to look at how I'm trying to tackle things. And especially because you are cut from similar cloth, and I thought, you know, what if am I missing something, right?
Yeah,
well, am I missing something?
We did an episode a long time ago called, I think we called it Meat Party, where we talked about like when you finish a thing, you should take a moment to celebrate it, to psychologically reward yourself for the effort that you put into the thing. And not enough people do that. Not enough people, when they finish a thing, stop to reflect on the finishing of it and congratulate themselves for that, to complete the cycle of that creation so that they'll have the strength to do it again.
Yep.
I wonder if there is some value in having a funeral, right? There's a reason we have funerals, right? To help us cope with it.
Exactly. I mean, we deal with loss like that all the time, and not that we have to dwell on it or whatnot, but I know goals are kind of this weird thing where they can be a little bit divisive. Like I noticed this time of year, you see a lot of people, commonly I'm one of them, ramping up with fresh reflection and goals. And I'm taking a little different approach. I'm going to iterate on that a little more. I'm doing an event this month, but I'm going to not make it as giant of an event where I spent a lot longer. Maybe it's because I'm a bit too busy with other projects, but I'm not doing as intense of a goal thing to try to build up over maybe the next 3 months. And just sort of, yeah, take breaks from it and keep chipping away and try to keep a good perspective on it.
When we get to talking about topic, I'm going to explain part of my thinking that ties into this curveball. Cool. Is why I structured at least what I contributed to the outline in the way I did. But cool. Yeah, I might be a bad person to ask about this kind of thing because, you know, I'm a person who loves improvisation. And every time I do make a life plan, there's an understanding between me and the paper that this is all subject to change. This could turn completely upside down tomorrow. I'll tell you what I do adhere to strictly, though, is not the details of the plan itself, but the intended ethos and outcome, not in the sense of numbers or anything statistical, but outcome in terms of what is the intended experience of the thing. So like with Kids Read Comics, when I'm working on the Kids Read Comics Festival with my co-organizers, lots and lots of things change. Like some years we run more programming, some years we run less programming, and every year it's an opportunity to reinvestigate how we build this two-day free comics festival that we put on in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I'm always open to negotiation, or I'm always willing to negotiate with my co-organizers on what it's going to look like this year, except for like some key fundamental principles of the show itself. Like there's certain aspects of the show, like in terms of feeling, in terms of, I guess, philosophical fundamentals.
Sure, yeah, principles, yeah. Principles. Principles are a form of a design constraint.
Yeah.
And design constraints are there to help you, to help inform your choices and how you go about building the thing you're trying to build.
And if any of those principles were ever broken, or somehow mismanaged or abandoned, that would be time for a funeral for me. That would be something where it'd be so emotionally difficult for me to deal with. I wouldn't be able to just keep on working. Right? So I guess with my work, most of the time I have a lot of control over those principles, right? Mm-hmm. I have the freedom and luxury to be able to say no to certain gigs that I am principally against. Right. That makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. So I'm hearing that it just sounds like that those are, and I think you've actually answered you've knocked the curveball out of the park in a few different ways. I mean, I think you time traveled, and in one situation you knocked it out of the park. The other situation, you sat off to the side sipping coffee. In another situation.
Don't make me
another situation. I turned to my left, and you were standing there. And then you showed up and hit the ball again. Anyway, it was crazy. So I think basically, yeah. And so you can have sort of the goals themselves could be the thing that you're really heavily concerned about. But even then, when you're really into improving, that's just another opportunity to make new, interesting choices kind of thing, right? And then but the more core directional stuff, that makes sense. If you're going against that would be a more natural place to feel the loss. And so I was kind of probing. It's like, so it sounds like the typical goals needing to pivot on, that's maybe not even a moment to experience much loss, right? It just was an interesting thing to consider. But like, but then you provided a situation of like, here's where I think I might actually feel loss. And I totally agree with that. Yeah, whenever I've been in situations like that, I get pretty sad and grumpy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that the decision-making process is ever easy, right? It's like I just did an episode of the Comics Are Great show, episode 92. So it's comicsaregreat.com/CAG92 with Ben Hatke. And we were talking about like sort of unboxing the really, really good guy character, like Superman. Trying to think of some other examples of that character. But
He-Man.
He-Man, yeah. So how did I forget?
Goku.
Goku.
Classics. Right.
And one of the things that we kind of hit upon during that discussion that really resonated with me is Ben said that those kind of characters are appealing to us because it seems easy for them to make their decisions because of their principles. Mm-hmm. They have they don't have a hard time determining the difference between right and wrong, whereas in real life, it's really hard because, like, oh, you hear a story about somebody who did a bad thing. Well, do I have all the facts? Do I know for sure? Was I there? I was not there. Am I? Is this hearsay? Is this, you know, is this real evidence? What's the real story there? It's hard to make it, to pick your position on things sometimes if you're anything like me. But those kinds of characters, when they have really strong principles, they just know in their gut and they operate out of this natural way. I'm not saying that adulthood is like that. Mm-hmm. It's not at all. But when you have a sense of your artistic principles, mm-hmm. it is a little bit easier. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right. Then you want to get the topic?
I think we've totally covered the curveball, and it makes a lot of sense. I think the whole topic of the principles and whatnot, it reminds me of our episodes on design and design constraints, which I think we did what, three episodes on that?
Thinking about design, didn't we? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
All right, we'll have to link to that in the show notes for this episode. But in the meantime. Time to go 10,000 feet up. Discuss the topic in abstract. You hear that? That's the SDF-1 behind me lifting up into the sky. The gravity generators are not going to fail this time. It comes smashing through the top.
I hate it when they fail. Bunts.
Or the anti-gravity generators. Sorry.
Yeah.
So I got to jot this down. Thinking about design series. Okay. So the main topic for today, holiday art improvement wish list. As people no doubt figured out from the title of this episode, whether they watch the video or download the audio podcast, what does this mean? Well, as we talked about at the top of this one and during the curveball, this is a time of year where a lot of people start talking about reflecting on the year behind us, thinking about the year ahead, time to make some commitments, resolutions, and so on. And a lot of that comes in, part of that discussion revolves around goal setting. I'm going to lose X amount of pounds by February. I'm going to write this many words for my novel by March, and so on. And rather than do that, I thought an interesting way to go at this is, and this goes back to the curveball in the sense that because I feel like as long as I'm not violating my principles, I don't care as much what I'm doing as long as it's creatively interesting, right? Mm-hmm. I don't need anybody else to tell me what I'm doing is good work as long as it's interesting to me and it adheres to my principles, right? So with that in mind, knowing that goals are only so concrete and so trustworthy because life is going to throw these funny things at you, let's think about the things I can control. Let's think about the things that I can commit to and I know if I put in time, like an exercise regime or something like that. What are the things I want to improve about myself? What are the things I want to improve about myself as an artist? Let's talk about those rather than I'm going to do this kind of book, I'm going to do that kind of book, I'm going to do this many pages or that many pages. What are the specific things, the intangible things in my work that I want to polish and refine and get better at in the years ahead? Now, we are streaming this live. We stream this live every couple of weeks on Google+. And you can go to leanandtart.com to actually get information on how to do it. But for the folks who are watching live, if you guys want to chime in through the Q&A app on the things you would like to improve and why, we'll be watching the Q&A app during the discussion and we'll be able to respond to you guys. But let's discuss the topic in abstract first. So, Rob, I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Cool.
Highlighting things that I want to fix. In other words, I'm saying, hey, Rob, I feel sad because I suck at certain things. I'm no good at this stuff, and I've got weaknesses. And maybe if I whine about them enough, somebody will give me the answer to make them better. Is that what I'm doing when I say? I mean, like,
you know, that's one approach.
I love how you always validate before you go in to contradict.
I suppose you have completely unwound my method. Validate it before contradiction. It's hard. I mean, so being wrong about stuff, people have a lot of interesting relationships with that. And you want and two common ways that's characterized are people will feel just when someone discovers either that they're wrong and they actually agree with it, or they disagree with it because they're getting critique from some other, you know, input source or what have you, or they're mad about the number in their bank account because of something or whatever. I mean, I just, people respond to that in different ways, right? And so, you know, you're sitting, if you have gone past that and decided, well, all right, that whether or not I'm disappointed about it, now I want to go into some course of action that will improve this. And I don't know, how do you want to tackle that? This is self-helpy territory.
Well, the reason I bring it up
you don't have to think you suck, right? I mean, or you can, and then just blow it off, right? I mean, I don't think that is really the interesting choice here, or the interesting information to observe that will help inform your choice.
I think the two extreme ends of the spectrum on this particular line of thinking are either A, you're a wimp for expressing your weaknesses, so don't do it.
Yeah,
suck it up and stoically endure. Or, oh, woe is me, won't somebody help me? Both are equally not interesting and not useful. Sure. So the next question is can we characterize the viewpoint of the person who says, you know, I saw that, this is something that young artists, and I'm guilty of this myself, young artists do this all the time, where they see an amazing piece of work by somebody, and they go, gosh, I have no business drawing. I'm going to cough my hands and move to, you know, the southern tip of Chile, because I have no right to call myself a cartoonist, because this person proved that I don't. What's the difference between that and the person who says, that person inspired me to get better?
I think scarcity is the big difference there.
What do you mean, scarcity?
So on one, I think that sounds like there's a presumption that there is not enough success to go around, uh-huh, or there's not enough skill to go around, or somehow that way is shut to you. And that's, you're making that assumption that path is not available.
Well, in a sense, it is, because that particular path is close to you, because that person, every path is close to you the moment somebody does it, right? You can't just copy somebody else's career.
Well, I mean, so we did quest number two? We talked about inspirations. This is like the callback episode.
Well, right? It is the year-end show.
It's the clip show without the clips.
I could pull up the quest while you talk about it.
And I was trying to, I do not remember the name of it. It was some silly obtuse pun because I wrote the quest. And but it had to do with exploring your inspirations. And then, and obviously that there's an assumption there that your inspirations aren't locking down all these different ways to, you know, to find your voice. They're actually they're comprising some pieces and molecules that form the complexity that is your voice. And to ignore them is to ignore you. You know what I mean?
Harvester
in a way.
Of Borrow.
What's that?
Harvester of Borrow was the name of this quest.
Okay, Harvester of Borrow.
That's a very Rob title.
It is. Anyway, it's fun to look at your own stuff and make yourself laugh. There's always the self-satisfaction angle. What do you think, Jersey, as far as
what
is copying, is taking that instant inspiration of someone literally did an act? Like, I remember, you know, like what entertainment did you watch during your teens and then immediately replicate that, right? Mm-hmm. What you know, was it, you know, like, for instance, I would watch a skateboarding video, then I would go skateboard,
I get that. I mean, yeah. Copying is the best. Copying is the absolute best to learn. And yeah. I highly encourage it in my classrooms. I tell my kids, trace all the time. If you're doing it to learn, just don't try to pass it off as your own work afterwards. Right?
Sure. Yeah. That's the, at an extreme. And it's still not bad in a context.
But all I meant was is that when somebody has a career and they've done a few things, like they say, the old saying goes, like, the door closes immediately behind you and everybody's got to find their own path into a creative career, right? There's no recipe, right?
And you're watching someone, you're seeing two things occur simultaneously. Someone has found their voice and they're sharing a performance of it. So they're demonstrating some asset within themselves that they've built up, and they're showing the product of it as at the same time. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I love that song. I love that comic. So of course you can't replicate their voice.
Right.
So that's shut. I agree.
Right. Well, I'm just saying, like, there's, like, you know, there'll be a story about somebody who gets a job at Marvel Comics because they sat down in the secretary's office the sitting area in front of the secretary and refused to leave. Like, they just couldn't be budged. And then when the editor came out, they made sad eyes at the editor. And it just happened to be the editor was just in the right mood that they thought that was funny. So they gave the guy a chance. And now the guy's got a career at Marvel Comics or whatever, right?
Gotcha.
And so then people read that and they go, well, that's what I got to do. I'll just do that. No, you can't, because that somebody's already pulled that stunt, you know. Whatever opportunity came along at just the right time for that person. And again, let's go back to something Kazu Kibuishi said early on, which I referred to in a few episodes back, is that preparing for opportunities is superior to looking for opportunities, right? So being ready for that when it happens, rather than trying to replicate somebody else's opportunity. Does that make sense?
It totally does. And then there's a huge factor of I don't mean this to be trying to propose that, you know, there's a deterministic fate kind of aspect to your environment. Yet, the kinds of opportunities that are available to others are, there is a scarcity there, right? So I guess we're saying there's parts of it that aren't scarce and there's parts of it that are.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, we got in the Q&A, Joe Gillespie is watching live. Good to see you again, Joe. Always glad to have you along for the show. Go ahead and respond to this on the air. He says, scarcity and seeing better illustrators at art school is the exact reason why I pursued graphic design as a career. My goal last year was to just draw, and draw. This year I plan on telling stories. That's the goal. Yeah, I mean, like, sometimes we can, unfortunately, I think a lot of people throw this thing around with, they're so good they made me want to quit. And they mean that as a compliment. But I'll tell you, if anybody ever said that to me, it would break my heart. It would break my heart to find out that somebody gave up because something I did was, like, quote unquote, so good that they had no business doing it anymore. That's the last thing I want to hear. I'd rather hear that, oh, your stuff was so good, it made me want to do that stuff too, right? I want to be as good as you are or something, right?
Yeah, that would be an incredible compliment.
It's not a compliment to be told that your stuff is so good it makes me want to go away, right?
Exactly. That would be a sad compliment, a backhanded compliment in a way, right? Because... Yeah. You know, it's against your motivation, but depends, right? I mean, if you're the kind of artist that you want to engender that scarcity, then there you go. It's out, you know. Yeah, there's opportunity for you too.
and I, like I said, I'm guilty of saying this myself. I've said this about artists before who, like, they're so good they made me really question whether or not I had any business doing this stuff.
Oh, totally.
And that's, I think that's a perfectly human thing to go through. Like what Joe is talking about, it's a perfectly human thing to go through. But then the important thing is to not let it stop you, right? You can have that moment of hesitation, but don't let it stop you. But unfortunately, I get a little itchy about that joke just because I do feel like it's not a pure joke. You know, there's something sinister in that joke. Like you said, it's a backhanded compliment, so...
No, it's interesting. And actually, there's kind of an emotional angle to this that I'm going to wait to until we go through something in the next segment.
Let's get through that, because we got to talk about, and I want to hit this fast, planning versus practicing, right? Something Brandon Dayton, who's done workshops for Lena Tart in the past, brandondayton.com, one of the, I consider to be, finest thinkers in cartooning right now, he talks about the monastic style of practice, where there isn't any kind of intended goal. It's more of a martial thing. It's just something you do. And it's not, you know, there's no preset, I'm going to lose X amount of pounds, or I'm going to get this much better or that much better. It's just something where you put in the hours because that's what you do. It's almost like a moral imperative, right, to draw every day. And then there's also, goal setting. There's goal setting. I'm going to do this amount, and this, I'm going to, you know, hopefully achieve these milestones and so on. But we can at least, whatever your stance is, we can at least admit that whatever thing you want to get better at, it's necessary to practice at the thing, right?
I agree. And I think, it's kind of like, in order to get better at expressing your ideas within a language, it's important to use the language. You gain experience and more connections in your brain through that experience to likely inform more complex choices as you go. And it keeps on feeding on itself.
Right.
Practicing does help you get more aware on a thing, or the skill does build. So, exercise our brain.
So here's where I'm going to pitch something at you, and then we can bounce it back and forth. So how do we plan to practice the thing? And is part of that planning identifying projects which will provide us with opportunities to practice the thing, which sounds way abstract, but I'm hoping we can whittle it down to be a little less abstract than that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
This is kind of, yeah, I don't very much know what you're talking about. I think it has to do with noticing when you're enjoying something new, and when, like, how you learn something. Like, when does it feel good to try that uncomfortable thing where you're not noticing how bad you are compared to other people or whatever. Like, when does that go away? And there's probably something in there to say, I might want to practice in using that. So for me, that's where I actually know that putting some kind of small commitment on the line, saying, I'm going to, you know, at every meeting I go to today, I'm going to sketch note it, right? That helps me. Like, so it's not a crazy commitment. It's a little challenging, but like, there's something about that I know I feed on. And so I'm like, okay, I notice I like that. I'm going to try to use that to help, you know, practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's different. Like, for you, Jersey,
when
do you find yourself keeping the practice going?
So anybody who follows my feeds like Instagram or Google Plus and et cetera, has noticed at some point or another that, hey, Thursday mornings, I wind up seeing a sketch from Jersey, and it'll say, Thursday morning sketching at Ruse, because I go to this place called Ruse Roast in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And I was just there this morning, and I did a sketch. I posted a Boulder and Fleet holiday card. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is that one of the guys I have coffee with every Thursday remarked that it's like the moment you get here, Jersey, like you'd say hi, and then the tablet comes out and you start drawing. He's like, either you really, really love drawing, or you're under such tremendous deadlines right now that you do not have time for pleasantries.
and you just said yes and kept drawing.
Yeah, and I was like, I said yes to all of that. Yeah, and I just kept going because I
wanted. I was joking.
No, that's totally what I did. I mean, I've been having coffee with these guys for like 2 years now. They know me by now. But and I listen. The funny thing is, I'm listening to what they're saying, and I respond when I've got something to say. But I don't have to sit there and think about what to say because I've got my tablet now. So what came out of that was when I got this Galaxy Note. What's it? Wasn't terribly expensive, $500. But it's still enough of an expense that I felt like I had to justify it. I better get use out of this thing for that kind of money. Mm. And so I set myself not a challenge, but sort of like a promise where I said, whenever I'm sitting and, you know, like instead of checking my mail or looking at Twitter or, you know, fidgeting with something, if I'm not reading or doing something instructive like that, I should be sketching on this thing. I should be capturing ideas always, or experimenting with things or playing with. So when I'm at coffee with the guys, instead of just sitting there looking at them while I'm talking to them, I'm talking to them while I'm sketching. While I'm like, if it's the 10 minutes before bed, as I'm just about to drift off to sleep, instead of like looking at my phone to go like, did I get any mail? It's time to sketch, you know? So I set that commitment upon myself and I stuck to it. And yeah, you're right. Like that little simple thing adds up to, you get a lot more comfortable with it. And it by having it be a, like you said, like kind of low risk, you know, I don't feel like I'm under any pressure to perform for anybody on that. Right. But it adds up. It adds up to where if you look at my Instagram feed, there's lots and lots and lots of digital sketches in there. And I bet, I haven't gone back to look myself, but I bet you'd see a marked improvement in how I'm getting, what I'm getting out of that tablet over time, right?
That's really interesting. I want to start to look at how some of the ways I practice. And two qualities I heard you describe, and tell me if you think these fit, are low pressure yet cumulative effort.
Yeah.
Low pressure, consistent, cumulative effort, something like that. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
And I would add on to that as like put an equal sign behind it, idea generation. Because I get more and more ideas all the time, not just story ideas, not just character ideas, but ideas about implementation for things, about new ways to approach projects. So I'll spill the beans on this because I don't know if I'm going to follow through on it or not. But that Boulder and Fleet thing I posted today, that holiday card, was a double-edged experiment. What I did is I sat down and I said, hey, I just found out how to make brush-like or chalk-like brushes in Layer Paint HD. And I posted the brush settings on my Google Plus feed so people can go and find that. And I said, wow, these chalk brushes, and I even made like a dry brush by like monkeying with the settings. Like it looks kind of like a dry brush. And I'm like, I wonder if I could replicate the look of the Boulder and Fleet mini comic that I did with the brush pen, but entirely digital.
Oh, wow.
So that was the first thing. I was like, okay, let's just see if I can do it. Let's see if I can make it look like I did it with a brush pen on my tablet. And I said, two, I wonder if I could make a comic, like a two-panel comic on this tablet that is high enough resolution to print, but clean enough and clear enough that it would look good in Instagram. Because a lot of people are using Instagram. It's, you know, it's in a lot of marketing talk right now. So the idea naturally occurred to me is like, oh, I wonder about Instagram as a comics delivery mechanism, right? Run the comic on Tumblr, right? You can set up an if this, then that rule to say, whenever I use this tag, post it to my Tumblr feed. So I make a webcomic Tumblr. I post the images to Instagram. They handle all the hosting. Instagram serves as my mechanism to promote the comic. And then it's archived on Tumblr. And I just use a URL, boulderandfleet.com, to point people at the Tumblr, right? Mm-hmm. So I said, what would happen if I did like 2,400 pixels by 2,400 pixels, which is 8 inches by 8 inches at 300 DPI? Can I draw something that looks reasonably good quickly, you know, under an hour to do a page? And can I make it so that it's legible on a phone, right? So it has to be square. Has to be clean and has to be legible on a phone, but also looks good as a comic printed later on, right? Those ideas are occurred.
That's a heck of a list of design constraints.
And before anybody gets like, oh, wow, that's very Machiavellian of Jersey. No, this is something that just kind of accumulated over time as I was doing lots of sketches. It was one what if, which added to another one if, which added to another what if, until I landed at this morning where I said, hey, I'll put all these what ifs together and see what I do. Right.
Yeah, so, that's Sorry, the process is really natural and I don't know. I'm not there's a couple of aspects of cumulative is that the practice and building experience can help with choosing new things to practice and adding different complexities to what you practice.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And yeah. which is a different way to react to it than saying I suck.
Yeah, I'm bad at this, Rob. And I'm.
Can you just hand your tablet to the next person? You're like,
here, I suck. What's funny about that is that I wonder if I should have added this to my list for the on the ground section is getting better at email because that is something I say a lot. It's like I suck at email, and I do. I try not to, but. That's something I continuously fail at. But that's like a whole other thing. Okay, let's close with this. Part of the reason, close the 10,000 feet up section.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Part of the reason I say I suck at email is partially based on, I guess I'm parenthetically saying at the end, is by most people's standards, right? There are a lot, certain things like email are victim to the assumptions of the users, And so some people, mm-hmm. when they send you an email, they expect an answer, you know, within an hour, 20 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And if you don't, then you failed their expectations, and then I suck at email, right? Some people think,
did you live up to your principles?
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's time to just do this. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not trying to, you know, troubleshoot with you, but I just thought it was another interesting tie back as far as chewing through these things, right? Because that is a good opportunity to say, is, you know, do I want to make a goal? Because I shop for goals in a similar way where it's like, oh, frustration or some kind of hang up. And then
bringing the principles back into it is actually a really good idea. That's a really good idea. All right. Well, do we want to go on the ground then?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, with that, then I will say, and I'll try to find a more positive and uplifting one this time. Oh, here we go. We're going on the ground, but that doesn't mean that our spirits shouldn't soar, Rob.
Indeed.
So, okay. Now for the fun part where we get to be all honest with one another. And again, folks who are watching live, this is your opportunity to chime in with the things you want to improve on, specific things about yourselves. And we're going to start off with our examples. But if you guys fire off some in the Q&A app, we'll respond to them on the air. Mm-hmm. So identifying our wish list of things we want to improve in ourselves artistically for next year. Who wants to start, Rob? Do you want to flip a coin or do you want to go first?
Sure, I can go first.
Hit it.
Happy to do it. So the wish list aspect of it, I really like. I like that. I like that that mindset in some ways, because it's sort of the it's a less severe way to say, here are my goals and I'm going to do them no matter what kind of thing. I like that.
Or I failed. Right.
Yeah, so it's a fun way to look at it. And so I thought of this as a few different primary scenarios that I'd like to explore. Things like my first one. I've had an interesting time this year with the creative commitments I've set out for myself, as in getting too stressed, getting just puzzling. Like, I think when I was looking back, I don't know if I did a too bad of a job of it, other than like what came out of me, but like I felt like I was stressing about it way too much. So I wanted to that's kind of like the frustration that led to this bullet point, which is I want to be better at sort of calm commitment, you know, like it's okay to actually plant a flag, draw a line, put a box on the wall, do, you know, whatever I'm going to do to say, I am, in a way, I'm writing a contract with myself. And this thing is what I want to deliver. I don't know if this is too squishy or what have you. And it might be a little bit weird thinking like, well, how do you know like you're more calm at commitment? And I think with a lot of these wish list things, it's going to have to do with continuing to journal and reflect on it, and then notice key things like oh no, I'm. There's a bunch of projects that I've been working on this year that if I look at what happened this year, I made a lot of progress. So I've been working on a video game since the beginning of the year. I've been working on a workshop that morphed into an ebook since last year. I've been working on, you know, a few other different things that have come up on the show, on the Polytechnic Cast as well. And I think my biggest difficulty, I'm sorry this is taking me so long to describe, but it's just that how I get worked up about them. Mm-hmm. And so I actually kind of like what I did this year. I just think I should do that without worrying about it so much. So I called it calm commitment.
That's a better rephrasing of, I think, one of the things I talked about last year, which was I said that the theme for 2013 was I wanted to have faith in myself, which is a very squishy, kind of hippy-dippy way of expressing what you just expressed. Like,
I think that's a pretty great way to express it, actually.
But this idea that I know I have the chops to get through it, right? And stressing out about it doesn't mean that I care more about it, right? You can care without freaking out about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to, I don't know if it sounds lame that, like, even though some of these things aren't finished, I see how far they've moved and how close they are to finished. And I trust myself. I'm going to finish the ones that matter to me. And some of them are pretty darn close.
Yeah.
I mean, I shared a picture on Instagram, for instance, of the close to finished manuscript for
a lot of paper there.
Yeah, it's about 200 pages.
Dang.
Yeah. So that was an adventure. And, you know, and wrestling with, well, what have I committed to? Is this too much? Is it enough? And anytime I was stressed, it's not like I was making better decisions or like I cared more about the project. I mean, that's a great way to put it.
Right. And I like what you threw in here. Emphasis means focus without pass, fail, commitment, worry. Oh my gosh. That is so put upon us, and we put it upon ourselves a lot. And I don't know where this comes from, and I don't know if we need to bring in some kind of like humanities professor or psychology professor to help us unbox this thing about what is our obsession with pass-fail, right? Mm. Remember Fail Blog, or what was it? Was that what it was called? What was that one where it was just pictures of people getting hurt or people falling down and always had the word fail over top of it? Do you remember that?
It sounds funny and sad at the same time.
Yeah.
Fail is I mean, we've gone into this before on this show. There's overall a theme of anyone who's thinking about how can we help the current generation of working adults and the next generation who's coming up, be ready. And this gets phrased as 21st century skills. It gets phrased as like, how do we reform the education system and all that? And I think a lot of that characterization is fair, but it's not just limited to the education system. There's overall, we have a culture that this is the UX aspect of my whatever coming out. We have certain cultural widely held beliefs and influencing social software things that exist because they've been successful. That's the first thing. Like we look at them now and we grump that people want to only, you know, have biases about working face to face and, you know, making sure, like you have all sorts of things memorized and can demonstrate knowledge in a way that's been traditional and all that kind of stuff.
And I don't hear typing in there. You must not be working, that kind of stuff.
Weird evidence. Your butt in a seat means that you're more trustworthy versus whatever. I mean, all sorts of, I don't know. I'm not using the best examples, but like there are biases that come from that. Partially because I don't purely vilify those biases. Mm-hmm. They were useful software at one point that needs to get upgraded. That's, and I really believe that actually. I try to remind myself of it when I get frustrated with that kind of thing. And so the failure thing, a lot of times it comes from our education system overall has an approach, but also it goes beyond that where it's Industrial Revolution. We were, a lot of us, you know, that's, you know, humanity, we were mostly agrarian. Then we had you know, the factories, industrial approach led to greater productivity and trade, and everyone started moving to cities. And then we had to get educated differently because if you didn't behave if you weren't concerned enough and you're working on a factory line, the person next to you might lose their hand, or you might, or whatever. I mean, we worked in that kind of severity of feedback where It goes nothing, 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 die. Nothing, 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 no hand for you.
Right.
that kind of stuff. And we don't have a lot of that going on anymore, right? And but I would argue a lot of our, we have a lot of biases that do that. And so whatever, we get all fail happy or fail worried. And
yeah,
that's whatever. I don't know. That's not scientific. Those are some feelings and observations on it. I don't know.
Well, I'll just tell you what my gut reaction is that I get very suspicious whenever I see people piling on. There's such a thing as outrageous things that happen in this world, but when it's, you know, some politician says something stupid on TV, or, you know, somebody is accused of something that we don't know for sure, and you see people piling on, that's when I start going like, okay, let's back up and let's look at this thing before we get too excited about it. All I'm pointing at here is that mentality reminds me of the things we artists do to ourselves when we're making a thing, right? It's very similar psychology, at least it seems to me, of saying, no, you missed your chance. You missed your chance. This was it. You didn't meet this deadline. Therefore, no more chances for you. Right? Mm. That's dangerous thinking to me.
It's another scarcity abundance thing again, right? Are my chances used up, or do I have more chances? Right. I don't know. Not to always simplify it to that, but again, like, I'm just like, wow, that's another thing. Like, and I like to think that I'm not that, you know, scarce-based, fear-motivated and stuff, but, you know, evidently I do run into that.
Let's make a lead into our t-shirt with, it's like a like an aspirin bottle, and just says, bottle of chances, limited supply, one-time offer.
Or limited, right? There's two bottles. Pick one, infinite. The other one, one left. One.
And then another shirt with the bottle empty that says, we're in a room with failure.
There you go. And people will be like, what? That's a weird shirt.
Hey, that's that cultural language kind of stuff that we've talked about in the past. Mm-hmm. Long-time listeners of the show know what I'm talking about with that. Okay, well, let's kick over to one of mine. And this is related to one of yours. I'm going to jump down to the middle of my list. This is a big one. A big one. Expressing myself more honestly in my work. And this is a realization that occurred to me through a combination of journaling and reacting to the work of others. And that kind of ties into something we were talking about earlier on in this episode, like the way you react to stuff that is impressive to you. Like, are you going to go, aw, shucks, what's the use? Or are you going to say, that person just lit a torch and said, come over here, and I'm going to go over there, I'm going to find out what's over there, right? Mm-hmm. So let me pull up. I'll tell the story of what I'm talking about here. I'm sure lots of people listening to the show are familiar with Dean Tripp's Something Terrible, which is an online comic, and I think he's printing, and I'm pretty sure he is. It's a very, very personal story about how he was abused as a child and how he overcame it through his admiration for fictional characters like Batman. Definitely not for kids. I would say that this is an adult-only comic, but it's a very touching and moving story. And, oh, he still got it on his site for only 99 cents. You can download the comic for 99 cents. It's a steal at twice the price.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, that's at 10centticker.com/somethingterrible. But we'll link to it in the show notes. But anyway, so I read this comic, and I'm moved like so many other people are. But even beyond the storytelling and the beautiful art that Dean Tripp has, what he did is I was looking at, this is a guy who rocked me with a reading experience that only could have happened because he was being so brutally honest with me. Now, I don't feel like I have anything to contribute by telling my biography the way Dean did, but it did make me look back at my work and say, gosh, am I being as honest? Am I being as personal in the work that I'm doing? And I realized I wasn't, and which led me down, and this has been going on for months, this kind of like recursive, you know, self-examination and journaling, but got me thinking that, you know, I've got essentially kind of like a basic formula for the way I like to do things. Like, my principles could be considered kind of a formula in that I like to do stuff that's aimed at young people. I like to do stuff that teaches young people. What I mean is comics. I like to make comics that teach young people and are aimed at young people. And I like them to generally feel like in the ballpark of the cartoons I grew up on, right? That's no secret. But I got so hung up on the poetry of trying to work within those design constraints, as you said earlier, that I wasn't thinking about, am I expressing anything from within, right? Hmm. There's a difference between getting hung up on the architecture of a thing and thinking about the expression of the thing. Does that make sense?
Mm. Well, yeah. And the comics medium, wonderful that it is, provides many, many, many facets to explore and get very concerned about, where we can totally occupy ourselves with just one consideration, how we pace our panels or whatnot too. I recently reread Sandland, and I just think Akira Toriyama is just a master of pacing. That it's like, what in the world? It's like I could say a negative comment. I will. It's like when I read my own comics, I think it's like someone got trapped in an elevator. And before they get off on like just 2-3 floors away, I'm gonna read a phone book to them. So a very much a lack of that space. Seeing that kind of thing, it's easy to. So it's not just that technique, but also there's beliefs and ideas get expressed in these mediums. And that's one of the frickin' reasons you put something out there is you share a piece of yourself.
And that's one of the reasons people respond to it. They respond to it because they feel like they're connecting with another mind somehow. And something Kim Holm said to me years ago, Kim Holm, Dunungaher Holm on Twitter, cartoonarchy.com. Mm-hmm. He's also led workshops for Leonard Tart in the past. One of the things he said to me that I kind of half subscribed to, but didn't fully buy into, but I accepted it as helpful critique of my career, is he said that that graphic novel I did, The Front, he said that was kind of a cartoonist's comic. It's like it was so full of architectural and structural things that were celebrating, look what the medium of comics can do, that, and that's not the stuff that readers care about. Like the general reader doesn't give a damn about like how you made a 4-page sequence that can be read in 2 different ways. Like the general comics buying public they're not coming for that, right? What are they coming for? They're coming for the author's voice. So that combination of Dean's comic and then those past reflections over the last couple of years have led me to realize that. Oh, and then there was one more thing on top of this. I just was listening to a podcast and I feel terrible that I can't remember which one it was. But it was something about indie films, and I heard somebody say this, and it's an oft-quoted line. So I don't feel too bad about not attributing it, is that if you're making an indie project of any kind, but particularly in this case, they're talking about indie films, it's like you better really, really care about the story because it's so much work to make this thing happen. On top of actually making the thing, but also promoting the thing and distributing the thing, all the stuff that goes into it, you better be able to answer the question, why does this thing need to exist? What is the important thing about that story? What is the thing you're trying to express? And I realized that this is one of the difficulties I've been running into with my personal work. I've had lots of great professional accomplishments this year, but my personal work, as usual, has stuttered in the process. And I think part of it is because I need to be more honest in the... how do I say this? Not in what happens in the story, but what the story's aboutness is, right? That needs to start coming from a more honest place. Does that say anything?
Yes, it absolutely does. And I was wondering if it needs to express more of your outlook on the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a test. Like, you know, did you need to say this, or why does this thing need to exist? Good questions.
Yeah. Beyond like, I like robots and I like talking animals and I like really cool action sequences. Okay, that's good. What else? Right? What are you trying to say to this thing after all? Oh, okay, well, let me write down a couple morals that would be good for children. No. What from your life you get to teach a young person now from your experience, mm-hmm. what do you have to say to that kid, right? Mm-hmm. Beyond don't steal candy. Beyond don't be mean to animals, right?
Don't pirate comics. Or something like that. I don't know.
Right. What's the fire? Where's the fire burning inside me that this is the thing that I need to say to the world, right?
Yeah.
This is the thing that I conquered, and I'm a better person for conquering this thing. And so now I'm going to put it into words or pictures or some combination. That kind of honesty is what I'm talking about. And mm-hmm. this is something I think we both struggle with is mm-hmm. honesty and communication, forthrightness, right?
Yes. Let's see. What is the forthrightness? I think there's probably just different. I don't know if I totally get traction on that word. It's tricky. It's the
because somebody could misunderstand us to say that
I would say uptightness. Like for me, it has to do with being I'm speaking for myself. The thing that I detect is an uptightness and fear. It's like I in a lot of chapters of Archaic Zoo, so one could say I did artistic choices to do this, but like I avoided calling out specific names, specific events in history, whatever the heck, that would have been really wise storyteller devices to find a way to work in to gain more connection and familiarity with the environment and the situation and the characters and all that. And because I was afraid of using it, I lost the benefit of that. And so I agree. Like I have a bullet on my list that's very similar, and not to, let's maybe now we can consider this as merging.
I wanted to ping pong it. I wanted to start with mine so that I could ping it over to you so we could talk about yours.
Okay, good. Because I'm doing the disclaiming because I don't think we're quite done on this one. So for me, it was the it's funny. This is another one of those moments where I bet anyone who's listening to this has experienced a piece of art at some point in time, and you had a eureka experience where you were like, just a point of clarity, a point of like, I'm feeling something like, not only did I just feel the thing that I'm reacting to in the story here, but I also, holy crap, because I care about storytelling, I just got hit with kung fu of like the kind I don't have. And now I feel this missing thing. And I don't know what my version of that missing thing is, but all I know is that it's missing. So, and you know, that can be annoying where now I detect it, but now I have no tangible goal I could put in my path other than like get that thing.
May 2001. That's how visceral that experience was. I remember the month and the year when one of those times happened to me. Oh my God. We don't have to go into it. It's just that I just love the fact that we've all had that experience, and when it happens, it hits you hard.
And it was one of those things where I think for me, some of the cognitive dissonance comes in when pursuing personal projects yet having a day job and all that kind of stuff. I think that's one of the little avenues where that can creep in. And I think that's becoming less and less of a concern, which means I'm making choices as far as having a more harmonious situation between day job and night job stuff, even though I continue to pursue both. But for me, it was, and there were many of these, but it was, I read Tyler James' book Over. It is a crass book. It's so funny, full of like poop and sex. And, you know, it's just, I don't even, we haven't had Tyler on the show.
Seriously?
Anyway, I'm just thinking back. I'm like, wait a minute. That's weird. Anyway, we've had it in. He's been an instructor multiple times at Lean Into Art.
We got to get him on the show. That doesn't make any sense that we haven't had him on yet. Holy cow.
Have we not had him on? Anyway, I'm stunned. anyway, it's his book over. I'm reacting to it where it's like I feel heartwarmed, kind of teary in different parts, laughing at crass jokes. I mean, there's this homeless man in the wheelchair that writes the most foul thing on signs, and it's a great bit, and it recurs and stuff. And he's got these things. I haven't read the book in years, but I remember this reaction to it where I was like, I am completely afraid of writing something like this. And I love it. And I know some of this stuff is in me, but yet I'd be afraid to put it on a page.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, but which means like that there's some aspect of emotional honesty that I'd want to bring that about. And anyway, who knows what else would come with that, but I think it's going to be smart to be more complete and expressive and let more of myself come into the work. Kind of thing. So I wouldn't put it as I've cut it. I can't remember the word I was reacting to, but
forthrightness.
Maybe yeah. That's it. So now maybe I agree more actually. Shoot.
Forthcoming.
Right? Yeah.
Forthcoming with who you are. Right. Less inhibited.
Yeah.
Uninhibited. Because the word honesty is loaded because it suggests that somehow we're being dishonest. When there's a difference between dishonesty and withholding the truth, right?
Ooh, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, a lie by omission, I guess. This is something that.
Yeah, I know you're right. Yeah, that's very true. Just avoiding different topics and whatnot.
Yeah, and I think that also ties back into like something earlier on when you're talking about like. Calm commitment also could lead to more forthrightness and expressiveness, right?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because one of the sub points you got here that I think is great is no such thing as overthinking. Are you going to stop apologizing for overthinking, Rob?
I'm going to try. And to me, that's tied into this. So some of it is just saying, you know what? It's all right that not everyone has to like how I analyze the crap out of most things. Okay. Yeah. But I actually like it. And I realized that I looked at my output for the year and whatnot. It's like I used to think that maybe some of my not putting out things had to do with some of the overthinking. And I think, yeah, that's true, but it's not black and white. There's part of that's just I examine stuff, and I love to do that. Yeah. So I think I'm going to worry less about it. And just That'd keep making awesome. Things.
So, oh, that would be awesome.
And let's see. This relates to a couple different things I like to think about, which is when I'm doing design work, I like to think of, and ever since I came across, I think the book that influenced this was, there was a bunch of things that influenced this. It was definitely like some people I worked with within, during 2012. And it was also the book, 100 Things Every Designer Must Know or Should Know by Susan Wineshank. Again, one of those books that gets mentioned a lot in the podcast. But I think we took a little break on it. But it helped me really appreciate that one of the best things to help counterbalance the overthinking is my emotional reaction to things. And I realized that I can design better visually and interactions in applications and whatnot when I let my emotions, because I mean I've practiced a lot, like just trying to set them aside and not worrying about them. It's by whatever, I'm not a freaking robot, but I'm like, if I'm experiencing some distaste, I'm just going to focus on coming up with the evidence or observations and or examples and things that help the case, and I will ignore the emotional aspect of it. But then I realized that I don't care how strong I get at rational exploration of things, there is a huge part of my intelligence, and I am a proponent of this for everybody, where now this sounds weird and self-helpy and formulaic, but I think of it as holistic cognition and also communication, where use that. It's also you inspired this too, Jersey, where you mentioned a really helpful technique to improve your storytelling is that when you are you're reading a comic, you're watching a cartoon or a movie or a TV show, and there's something that it does that affects you. And when you notice that it affects you, pause and observe that. That's what I'm talking about right there. That emotional thing, it hits you in the gut. Something happened. Emotions are leaking out. Don't bottle it up. Yeah. You know, follow it. Use that to now. And I realized, like, I will have just a strong reaction to certain things. And where I had been in the habit of getting into the emotional thing, I let it sit for a little while, and I'm like, oh man, or I love or I hate this or whatever. And then I start exploring. So I didn't dismiss it, you know. Anyway, whatever. I don't know if that covers. I don't know if that makes sense. It's almost like a beacon. It's like a something that you know, getting a notification when I got close to something, and then not knowing what I'm close to, and then I can explore and sort of let them battle it out, like or make friends and dance it out, whatever, the emotion and the rational. Anyway, I think I will express things in a far more emotionally honest way by continuing to pursue that.
I suspect you are right, and that is exactly what I was talking about with my work. Oh yeah, you see what I had pulled up in the queue for image pull.
I do.
Yeah. Oh, I better not just leave everybody hanging now. It's that I had this ready because I was like, well, you know, there was a guy that we both admire who knew when to be emotional and when not to be emotional, right? And
yeah,
would it be a lean into art cast if we didn't mention Mr. Miyagi?
The best look ever.
That look
at the end of the first movie. Yes.
Yeah. That's the look that we're all craving as artists. I would venture to say he's the patron saint of the show.
He is. In some weird way, him and Ryan Estrada, and yeah, they all they hover around as Jedi ghosts whenever we podcast.
It's Obi-Wan Kenobi ghosts.
Yeah. There's got to be a few others, you know. We need some female leaders in that pantheon of Jedi ghosts also.
We do. Mm-hmm. We do. Well, we've got leaners
who have been
contributing in that regard, which we talked about in the last episode, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Okay, can we talk about like a specific drawing one real quick?
Yes, please.
Okay. Because one of the ones I had on my list, and this goes back to being inspired and impressed by other people, and asking myself, well, why am I responding this way to their work? What are they doing that I want to unbox and I want to incorporate into my work? And I'm going to go ahead and mention Jake Parker of MrJakeParker.com. And what is he on Instagram? Because, I mean, it's worth it just following his Instagram feed. Oh, it's just Jake Parker.
Word. His Instagram's a crazy jackpot of...
Yeah. It's visual, bonkers.
Yeah. Well-categorized visual treasure.
Damn it, Rob.
It's amazing. Yeah. You will be delighted every time you open up Instagram. Follow him.
Yeah. Yeah. And his character designs are just incredible. They're so great. And I was trying to figure out, what is it about his character designs that I find so darned appealing? Now, it helps that he did a talk at the Ann Arbor District Library, which I moderated. And in that talk, he talked a lot about shape and form and its importance in character design. And I wish to God we would have recorded it. Mm. But I believe there's a Comics Are Great episode where he talked a little bit about that. He was on the show with Dave Roman, and I'll look it up for the show notes. A link to it. But or you can just go to comicsaregreat.com and search for Jake Parker. He's been on the show a number of times, and he always brings really, really intelligent conversation to the show. But as I was looking at his character designs, I thought, Oh, there's something about the way he uses shape and form. His characters are always existing in a three-dimensional space, even if they're just standing there, right? You feel the weight of his characters, even if they're just in. Like, I'll pull up some of the other designs that he did. This is just a static pose of an alien from his upcoming book, Space Skull, right? But you feel the weight of that character, right? The way he's posed, the way he's standing, the way he's rendered the shape. Like, look at this. What we're looking at for the folks who are listening to the show in audio only. If you go to his Instagram feed, it's an orange alien with a black kind of like scuba suit, and he's holding a knife, and he's got like a long reptile tail, and his face is kind of like this weird Admiral Akbar face, right? Mm-hmm. But look at that ridge on the neck. Look at that simple ridge that he put on the top, like where you see the spine protruding, right?
Yep.
Simple little thing. It's not.
Like, you can feel that there's musculature there.
Yeah. And it's just a few lines.
And it's not like it's overly rendered muscles or anything.
Precisely. It's very simple work when you look at it up close. But he puts everything in just the right place so that it suggests a nice three-dimensional form. And when I was looking at my own stuff going like, well, what's mine missing that his has got? That's what I got. That's what I want to figure out, and I want to start aping this. I want to start moving in the direction. Jake, again, lit a torch, put it in the ground, said, hey, everybody, look over here. And I said, well, I'm going to go over there to find out what's worth looking at. I noticed that some of my stuff, I can capture dynamism and energy and action in my stuff, but sometimes the stuff can look a little on the flat side for my taste. I don't think I've quite got the sense of shape and form quite as deeply as Jake does. That's one of the things I want to take on for this next year is I want my characters and I want my designs and my illustrations in general just to have a little bit more attention to shape and form. Not much more to say about it beyond that.
Yeah, it's actually amazing work. I just, a correction. I think I was thinking of did we say his Pinterest or his Instagram?
Oh, his Pinterest.
So obviously follow him on both, right? Yeah. His Pinterest is the amazing, cataloging.
Yeah.
He's doing a lot. But his Instagram is super cool work.
Yeah. Follow him in both places, definitely. Yeah. But his Instagram is just his own work, whereas Pinterest, he collects amazing, amazing work by hundreds and hundreds of other artists, and it's a one-stop shop for inspiration. I mean, it's really great. Like whenever I'm sitting down going like, well, what do I want to draw today? Like when I'm at the coffee shop and it's time for me to sketch, what do I want to draw today? Open up Jake Parker's Pinterest feed, and something will grab your eye. So
yes,
we should wrap up pretty soon. But I want to close with one of yours, one of the items on your list.
Oh, Jersey. Well, I'm good. I mean, I guess I can be minimalist and sort of tease a little bit because my other one I was thinking about is I want to leave space. And I'm out.
Well, are you going to redesign your office to look like an Apple store?
Let's see. Yes. No, let's see. I have enjoyed some aspects of my schedule this year. But then I also, I got overwhelmed and stressed at different points, not to the point where it stopped me from producing or whatnot, but the experience, I wasn't enjoying my different creative sessions as much, different times because of, tensions between, which project and whatnot. Sometimes I realized that. So recently I went to the airport, flew and all that kind of stuff for a work trip and day job trip. And there's time where I had more different like down times. And overall, like I carry my tablet, my little MacBook Air and, some sort of, physical drawing utensils and paper. I could easily, and also a smartphone. Like I could keep myself busy to infinity with all these different apps, different projects, and I could work totally nomadically. And I also carry a wireless access point. So,
oh, cool.
I could work totally nomadically, no matter what. Doesn't matter. But I took advantage of and was reminded by that experience of sort of the differentness of the situation. So instead of going through the ritual of, okay, what's on my list? What do I need to do one of these things to warm up quick? So I'm firing in all cylinders. Do I not, should I just pick a task and go, whatever, right? But then, you know, just keep chopping every single time I come back down to, you know, my
breaking
office in
boards
the basement.
Is the terminology you used a lot this year?
Yeah, breaking boards. I guess these are intertwined, these different goals. So it's sort of being better at calm commitment means that I know, I guess I'm not as worried about breaking boards anymore.
Yeah.
I know I can put the right force in the right place at the right time. I also want to explore, just unplanned space.
Mm.
And cause I know like this is another place which also ties into to my other one, which, allowing, the room to explore is when I can be also informed by my emotions and then maybe try more things I'm inspired by, that kind of thing. And, see where that leads, because there's a lot of good learning and just fun, just having a good time.
And having a good time, allowing yourself to have a good time suggests that, well, your studies or following things that inspire you is no longer utilitarian, because you can't directly connect it to something else that you are currently working on, right? You're not making it perform double duty. You're not, and this is something I've kind of railed on in the past, as I said, like, I always try to make sure that everything I'm doing relates to something else that I'm doing, so that it's constantly accumulating. Keep producing, keep the production line flowing. This is America, after all. But going back to one of your earlier points, isn't being playful, in a way, trusting yourself to find the utility in the thing that you're following as a diversion, right?
Yeah, and the utility may have just been you satisfied a curiosity.
Yeah. I also like this idea of uncommit to overcommitting. I had this first eureka experience myself where working on this graphic novel and fulfilling freelance obligations. I found myself working like a 16, 17-hour day a couple weeks back. And I don't remember if I posted about this publicly or not. But I'm in my 16th or 17th hour, and I'm physically fine. I mean, I got a sore shoulder a little bit from, you know, like just occupational hazard, right? You're doing this with your arms all day, you're going to get a sore shoulder. But I'm still alert enough, and the work is satisfying. I'm not complaining about a long day because, after all, I'm storyboarding and I'm making comics and I've got cartoons playing in the background. It's a charmed life. It's pretty awesome. But on that 16th hour or so, Anne's sleeping. Haven't seen her all day. Maggie, my cat, has got her paws on my leg. And she's like, come on. She's like, come on, give me, I haven't seen you all day. You know, it's my time. It's my time. She's meowing at me all sad. And this crushing feeling of, you know, I missed out on an evening with my family, right? To do this drawing stuff. And I love doing the drawing stuff. But would have liked to have been around my family a little bit tonight. At least a little bit, you know. And I thought about something I said when I was in my early 20s, and I hear lots of people say, is like, you know, that this kind of like macho, like, I worked a 25-hour day today. Nobody loves comics more than me. And I looked at that kid, that younger me, and go, you know what? To heck with you. There is no glory in working a 17-hour day. It doesn't make me feel macho. It just makes me feel like I missed out on being with my wife.
And I mean, I do think it's one thing when it is a an infrequent event.
Sure.
Because, you know what? I actually do like that sometimes in the whole let's see, it doing that kind of push and sort of an intense creative, immersive, focused, tunnel vision, whatever kind of experience. There's a certain kind of doing that once in a while, like, hey, a 24-hour comic day is very much like that. It's a little bit of an art challenge, but like there isn't an art challenge as a lifestyle thing that seems like a good idea, at least to me.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, I've been at times in my career, definitely in my 20s as well as, and yeah, crazy long hours that I'd work. And I don't think I'd always get as much out of that as I could have.
No, I totally agree. Because I love mini art challenges too. Like Mini Comics Day every March is super, super fun. Let's make a mini comic in 8 hours, see if we can do it. Never had the stamina to do a 24-hour comic day. But I think those kinds of things, like that's like running a marathon or doing any kind of like strenuous single challenge. But mm-hmm. as a continuous thing, I think at least the part of the narrative that I take issue with is hours spent equals like value of commitment, right? Mm. When I think an equally elegant or equally compelling goal to me is to get more out of less. I put in 3 hours today, but I did twice as much interesting or twice as interesting work, right? Than when I put in double the hours, right? That'd be pretty cool.
Or yeah, and also work that if it's connecting with who you want to connect with. People are saying, "Oh my gosh, that was whatever. That was exciting. That was funny. That was," they're sharing their reactions. I mean, that's another way. Connecting with the audience.
Yeah.
But okay. But yeah, the hours, not the best evidence to go by.
Well, and that goes back to an earlier point. This is part of a bias that comes from an earlier time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and right. It is, I mean, it's not a bad idea. It's good to get a lot of practice, yet I don't know. There's something more. There's something like this, right? Like what we just went through to think about what do I want to do to have new interesting experiences that lead to probably the kinds of outcomes I want to see. The experiences that lead to the experiences from the thing.
Did you even? Those weren't words, Rob.
Uh-huh. You heard well, me.
They were, but there was very little meaning that I could ascribe to them. No, I'm teasing. I'm teasing. Did you realize, Rob? This is the last show of 2013 for Leonatar.
Yeah,
I didn't realize that until just now.
Is it? It's for the Lean Into Art podcast. For this might be a good time to transition because we could mention those of. There actually might be one more that we have to figure out the schedule as far as how we're going to do it. But we do a sister brother podcast to the Lean to Art cast called Extra Lean. And those of you who subscribe to our mailing list will be able to get alerts about once a month. And we'll have a few and kind of point you to them and share a few other helpful links and whatnot. And I see Jersey has pulled up here.
Oh,
the new update to leanintoart.com.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so yeah, let's talk about this. So, Rob, you worked like a madman. What was it, last week? Oh, my gosh. How fast did we move on this? That is so cool. Mostly Rob did this, everybody. Flipped some switches, changed some wires around. And we have
sat on my keyboard. Something happened. Squarespace.
And we got a new Lean Into Art site. It's still at leanintoart.com. But one of the things that we brought back was something that was actually we were getting questions about. Is like we took down the workshops page while we were trying to figure out what we want to do next with products, quote unquote, on the Lean Into Art site. Mm-hmm. And we brought back some of the workshops. Not all of them yet, but some of them are back. And this is the twist, is if you go to leanintoart.com/workshops, you will find out that all of the workshops that are on there right now, which I will say includes Comics Fundamentals, taught by me, FATAM, A Detailed Exploration of Comics, Sound Theory, and Design, Storytellers UI Tools by Rob, Turning Jokes into Comics, Laughing Yeti Monkey Spaghetti, and Making Video Games from Your Creator-Owned Comics, all of those workshops are now pay what you want, meaning you can get them for free if you want. Download them. You can stream them. There's no DRM. You know, you could give them to a friend. And especially, I mean, if people are listening to this like right after we recorded it, only a few days left till Christmas, and if you're looking for like a great last-minute gift, you can get these for free. Or if you think that there's some value associated with these things, if you think like, hey, you know, these guys work hard on this stuff and I get some, you know, a substantial benefit out of it, you can pay what you want. You can pay $1, you can pay $10, you can pay $500, whatever you think it's worth.
Which, seriously, like, so Jersey has a kind of crazy. It's like one of those classic electronics commercials where, you know, the person would be throwing a stereo through a window level of bundle, right? Where, I mean, he bundled like 7 hours of his workshops, actually, which includes Comics Fundamentals, which is essentially like Jersey's comics overview that, I mean, it gives you a great course on exploring Jersey's approach to making comics. And on top of that, he also had bundled in this which other couple of workshops I'm trying to remember.
Okay, so yeah, my thinking was is that like, okay, it's one thing to talk philosophically about how to make a comic from soup to nuts, right? Like, okay, well, let's start with characters, let's start with world building, let's start with generating story ideas, and then thinking about how to put these things together, and then closing with a talk on what are our different format options, whether you do print or web, what are the different concerns, is it going to be delivered to a tablet, delivered to a phone, thinking about that. Okay, well, that gets us thinking, that gets us started making a comic. Well, what can I provide in this package that would actually help you fulfill that? And so I included 3 more hours of content, which was coloring in Adobe Photoshop Elements, right? And this ties in, by the way, this is a workshop that I've led in Ann Arbor for 7 years now. Is like a 6 to 8 week course. This is condensed down to 4 hours. And when I teach at Ann Arbor, I always concluded it with a class on coloring in Photoshop because got some art now. Now you want to digitize it. Now you want to turn it into a book, right? So, and then I also included lettering in Adobe Illustrator, which is like a basic how-to if you know nothing about using Adobe Illustrator. But if you have access to it, it walks you through designing sound effects, sound elements, and word balloons. And then I also included a sequences and consequences workshop, which is just taking note cards, just taking like index cards and scribbling on them, just like doodles, and then rearranging them. And it teaches you editing, restructuring, reformatting, because like you make a story in one direction, and then you take those index cards and you rearrange them to see if you can find an equally valid story with the rearranged tiles. And part of this comes out of this notion that I think a lot of beginning cartoonists, at least in my experience in teaching for this class for 7 years, they get hung up on this idea of, I got to start at the beginning. And when I say, no, start in the middle. Start wherever it's interesting for you and then work your way back. You can figure it out. Just start where it's interesting, where your energy is. Because you can always edit it later. And I've actually had students say to me, and I did this one class where I actually mandated it, that you're starting on page 5, then you're going to go back to page 1, then you're going to go to the final page, then you're going to go to page 2 and then fill in the blanks. And I saw this one kid really have a problem with that. He's like, you just don't do that. That's not how stories work. You go from beginning, middle, and end. You don't start in the middle. That's wrong. Like, not in my class it isn't, pal. You know, start at the end if you want to. So sequences and consequences was designed to address that need of understanding that the what we respond to in stories is the big image, the compelling image, and not necessarily the very first line of the book, right? And by just doodling on index cards and rearranging them, it reacquaints you with this idea of like, it's about blasting ideas on the paper and then arranging them after you've done it. The way a filmmaker shoots a lot of film and then edits it, right?
Yeah. And I mean, so in a lot of ways, you provide this overview of the utilizing the comics medium, a couple then two different tools that are really helpful in sort of the they're really strong tools for helping you with that craft, which now, you know, just worth mentioning, there's things like Adobe Creative Cloud where you could be obtaining those tools a bit easier and safer and whatnot than, you know, other methods, and cheaper than, you know, the formerly official method, right?
Do you like Adobe Creative Cloud? Because I haven't tried it out yet.
Yeah, I do. I use it.
There was a lot of backlash when it first came out. A lot of people were like, I'll own my software, thank you.
Yeah, I don't know. Depends on your outlook and things. It is a mixed bag. Obviously, it'd be nice to know, like, I pay one price and what have you, but at the same time, there is an interesting, it's a very different situation for like right now I have the whatever mega version. I was able to get it for $50 a month, right?
Okay.
Which is kind of steep. It's like, I don't really want a $50 a month bill, but like I do have access to the entire suite of Adobe tools. And that's been fun. So I was trying some of the things that are like their newer experimental stuff, like what Animate, which is like an HTML5 version of Flash, kind of. And of course, it, you know, includes the latest Flash and the latest Fireworks, which actually isn't that new because it's been slowly starved. I miss Fireworks. And but yeah, Photoshop, Illustrator stuff too. And there's a lot of interesting updates with the UI, whatever. Why am I putting on a commercial for Adobe right now? But but anyway, it's interesting that like you can use that knowledge too with the Adobe Illustrator class. And it's just more approachable. It's more affordable, right? Than having to just get the big Illustrator license and whatnot that you used to have to. It's neat that, well, that we have that's a good argument for Creative Cloud.
Yeah.
Basically. But anyway, I'm sorry. I got sucked myself into a tangent there. You rounded off with like how you get stories to now make use of this medium through one approach, right? Anyway, that's a heck of a holistic bundle, in my opinion. I have gone through all of those workshops, and they're amazing.
Oh, at thanks, Rob.
The price that they were at, and now they're paid what you want. So, man.
And turn about as fair play, making video games from your comics is also an excellent theoretical exploration of demonstrating that if you are making comics, if you are solving these storytelling problems, you already are halfway there to making a game. And I would also almost submit that saying video games is almost too narrow of a perspective, because you could take what you learn in that course to make any kind of game, whether it's an on paper game or a board game. Because you talk about how like the narrative, the emotional arc that you follow in a narrative is related to this thing called the fun loop, which if you understand that principle, you can provide a good gaming experience around your comic. And as we enter more and more into an age where it's not just enough to make the narrative, you have to think about, what do they call that? Transmedia, right?
Sure.
What other ways can you incorporate experience into your narrative, right? And so, like, there's things like, and we were talking about this in the Comics Are Great show recently with Eli Nyberger and Dave Carter, Make Your Comic as Awesome as a Game, where I borrowed a lot of principles that I learned in this workshop to bring to the discussion. But we talked about, you know, like, people they'll make a novel, but then they'll also make an accompanying iPhone app where, you can look through the iPhone to find hidden things from the other dimension of that narrative in your real world, making you participate in the narrative of the book, right? But this idea persists that it's not enough to have the narrative. You must have also some kind of experience surrounding the narrative. You can make all sorts of different kinds of games. And cool thing about the workshop, and this is part of me like sort of congratulating you for having similar outlook on pedagogy that I do, is that you're sort of showing us that we already know how to do it. You're just putting words on it and putting structure to it so that we can make a more informed investigation on our own on the subject. So,
That workshop is also what led to led to the book, what became the book that I'm close to completing, that is actually being teased on the site. So if you're interested and want to be notified when that's coming out, that's on the books page now, which is the game construction kit, Underwater Tomato Ninja edition.
And you can find that all at leanintoart.com, which I'm sure you are well aware of if you've been listening to the show for any amount of time. So let me round off this little segment by saying thanks to the news about the new workshops page dropped like a few days before this episode aired. And thank you to all the leaners who spread the word about it, because we didn't really like do like a huge press release kind of thing. We just kind of like let it drop like in our Twitter feeds, like, hey, guess what? New Leanint Art page. And some people got really excited about it and really helped notify everybody else that this change happened, where the workshops became pay what you want. Ryan Estrada led the charge on that as well. But thanks to him and all the people like Ashley Knapp and Joe Gillespie and a bunch of people who helped spread the word and supported us in that. And it means a lot to us. So it was cool to see people downloading it for free and otherwise for the last couple days. A lot of fun to know that people are availing themselves of that stuff. So thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you very much.
So I guess all that's left to say, Rob, is thanks for another great year of doing this thing.
Yeah, thank you, Jersey. I learn a lot by doing this, and it gives me an opportunity to share what I'm learning. And I really enjoy making this with you.
Yeah, me too. It's a ton of fun. So everybody, if you enjoyed this, if you had a ton of fun, you could go to leanintoart.com/workshops, or you could go to iTunes, give us a star review, however many you think that we deserve. You don't even have to write a full review, although full reviews, like writing words about how you feel about the show, helps a lot to help more people find this show. Or if you're watching this on YouTube, you can just give it a thumbs up. That helps more people find the show as well. And if you leave a comment under the YouTube video, I think you can leave like an option now so that it also appears in your Google Plus feed. So it sort of like reshares the video on Google Plus. I don't know how effective that is, but, you know, can't hurt.
Worth a try.
New technology. Things are changing all the time. So, but yes, thank you to everybody who's downloaded and listened and supported and participated in our quest this year. And we wish you guys the best holiday season and an exciting new year full of awesome creative art challenges. Anything you'd throw on top of that, Rob?
But hey, don't overpressure yourself. Have some fun too.
That's a good way to close it out. All right, everybody, until next time, I've been Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of leanintoart.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.